Such wars are sometimes more threatening and result in more victims. Like the war that I want to tell you about. A war that you may not have even imagined, but we are in the middle of the battlefield. I want to start my story with a question. Why is fast food so popular in this era? One recipe and one taste. Everything is similar. Ready-to-eat foods are without stories because there is no time to tell stories in the middle of the battlefield. We can find them in hypermarkets. There is no story here. The story of each product is summarized in barcodes and a few lines and numbers below them. It doesn't matter where the food comes from, they say here instead of everywhere. Here, like on the battlefield, everything happens fast. Speed is a modern phenomenon that has become a disaster for human lives and the earth. Speed in food production and consumption means harming Mother Earth. It means the ruination of water, soil, and the environment. Fast food causes the loss of diversity and cultural values and even increases the number of hungry people, and it harms people's health. But vegan movements were formed everywhere in the world and were more widespread than entomophages. Vegans believe that for the health of humans and the environment, and to respect the rights of animals, humans should basically stop eating meat and become vegetarians.
You're safe now, cow.
Thank you.
You're not food. You're my friend.
Food or friends? Food or friends? Friends! Friends! Guys, come on.
Friends! 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 Friends!
Vegan-friendly restaurants are expanding with this idea. In these restaurants, the food has a look of meat, but with vegetables as its components. This restaurant only serves vegetarian meals, and it is full of things that reminds us of former times. The names of the dishes in this menu were very strange. There were names like del barana, candle, butterfly, flower, and mastan, salamat, mikonand. Old things and strange names mean that we have to go back to the time of grandmothers, the time of family harmony, to the time before the war, a time when food had a different meaning with family gatherings. But if all the signs in the city are filled with names like aunts and uncles, will cooking and eating habits really go back to the time of our grandmothers? Apparently, instead of passion, the citizens here use bombs, RPGs, and armored personnel carriers to name sandwiches. In these restaurants, passion becomes meaningless for the customers, and they don't care about the taste of the foods either. The appearance of the foods are more important than their taste in such restaurants. Television was slowly forgotten by the rise of social media. The age of television was the age of mass production, and the era of social media is a period of mass consumption. In this era, everything is related to illustration. The value of products are determined by the attractiveness of their images. In the era of image consumption, McDonald's, which invited everyone to eat the same type of food, gradually fell out of favor, giving way to tasters who advertise foods with a completely different appearance. In this new battlefield, these tasters give the order to attack. Sauce, cheese, and Instagram. If these three items are properly put together, they can do miracles in the age of visualization of the world. Prayer for the Whale is the name of a film about food. Food of Alaskan people who eat whale meat. But before hunting a whale, they pray with it. They believe that the whale gives itself to the hunters.
Thank you for this day, for the gift of the whale.
I asked Kili Yuyan, the director of the film, about these strange customs and beliefs.
He's saying, thank you to the whales for coming back year after year. Thank you for giving yourselves. The Nyupyak always say that the whale is giving itself to you. And you can really see that. The whaling is good for the food. It's part of the community. It's culturally very powerful because it's the primary source of identity. Also, you know, there are whaling cultures, so they feel very much tied to the whale. The fate of the whale is the fate of the people. And so all of that is 100% integrated.
Seems that whaling is something tough to do. Didn't people of that region try to change their diet to get rid of whaling difficulties?
No, you know, Inuit peoples eat all meat. And it's very difficult for outsiders to understand that that is a necessary part of life. And that's how, culturally speaking, that's important. I'm native and most of us are lactose intolerant. You know, we can't have milk. Hopefully there is a perspective that people can understand, which is that cultural preferences for food are very important. Forcing people to adopt to a different foods equals health problems like obesity, diabetes, all these kinds of things. And then on top of that too, you know, you kind of lose a sense of who you are. And when you lose your identity, then that leads to big problems.
Kili, have you ever been passed any judgment on that with your railing, your damaging environment and nature, or something like that?
This whole thing was very controversial. Originally, like in the late 1970s, the U.S. government came in and looked at the population and they tried to study it. And they said, hey, you guys, there's only 800 whales left and you hunted 100 this year. There's not going to be any left. You know, the elders came at them and said, no, you're totally wrong. You're off by an order of magnitude. Like there's way more whales than that. You think we don't know, like, you know, that if we're hunting all these whales, we would kill them all. But the government said, and the International Whaling Commission came in and said, no, you can't hunt any whales. And they made them do better science, really. And when a couple years later, after they had done all the studies, they came back with a number and they said, oh, I'm sorry, guys, we were wrong. There are actually 8,000 whales here, not 800.
So it seems that despite the fact that meat is the main food of people in that region, and the people go on with whaling, yet biological balance is not tipped over there. Neither people did not lose their healthy, nor the environment destroyed. Why there is no such disbalance in our era?
The idea that there is not balance, I think, on some way is a result of civilization and sort of like, I don't know, maybe even capitalism. I mean, there's the whole idea that if there's going to be a resource, that no matter what, you're going to end up destroying that resource, you know? I think that's a very strange idea, and that's not human at all, you know? It's a very strange little kind of quirk of what dominant cultures have now. But, I mean, you know, if you live close to the land, it's really hard to not have that balance, right? Because if you've lived there for thousands of years, you've figured out how to have this balance.
People who pray for their food, people who eat meat, but do not disturb the balance of nature and environment. People whose identity and culture are mixed with the food they eat.
One of the probably the best ways that we could try to achieve this balance too, especially if you're talking about cities, is I think one of the hard parts about modern life that makes it very easy to be out of balance is that we don't, there's too many steps in between where the food comes from or where the resource comes from and then what we eat.
Kiliyu Yan believes that we will approach the balance if the intermediaries are removed and humans establish direct contact with the earth. This is not an easy task in today's world. How can one think about reducing the distance between the man and the earth in the world of profit, speed, and capital? Mohammad Qayyim Panah has taken good steps to reduce this gap. Mohammad tries to reduce the distance between farmer and consumer with an innovative idea and by establishing a startup. The story of the product is the story of who, where, and how each product was grown and produced. These stories make other new stories, different stories. The story you heard was not the story of war. It was a story of the closeness of hearts and love. But the war is still going on. Man's war with himself, with animals and plants, and with the earth. We may not have started this war, but we are definitely involved in its fate. The continuation of this war depends on the choices we make for our daily food.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
in the limelight.
Senior Hezbollah officials say Lebanon's firm position and the resistance movement's efforts help the country safeguard its maritime rights. In indirect talks with the Israeli regime and eventually forced the Zionist enemy to retreat. They were reacting to a draft agreement reached between Lebanon and the Zionist regime that would potentially end a long-running maritime border dispute in the gas-rich Mediterranean Sea. We've taken a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The English website of Fast News Agency writes, Lebanon has approved a maritime border deal with Israel, which President Michel Aoun, stressing that the country has recovered a large swathe of its territory without even conceding a single square kilometer to the Zionist regime. The Lebanese President Michel Aoun said in a televised speech on Thursday, 13th of October, I announced the approval by Lebanon of the final version prepared by the American mediator to delineate the southern maritime border. Michel Aoun described the deal as a historic achievement and said Lebanon was able to recover a disputed area of 860 square kilometers. He said Lebanon did not concede a single square kilometer to Israel, adding that his country had seized full control over the Qanar field. Michel Aoun said, This indirect agreement responds to the Lebanese claims and fully preserves our rights, stressing that no normalization with Israel took place and no direct talks or agreements were held with it. The announcement came a day after the Israeli regime's cabinet approved by majority the formula for the maritime border demarcation agreement with Lebanon. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah, the leader of the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, said on Tuesday, 11th of October, that the movement will not recognize any maritime border deal between Lebanon and the Israeli regime until it is officially signed. Sayed Hassan Nasrallah said, We will remain vigilant until such a deal is finalized, noting a proper deal should meet the Lebanese government's demands. A senior Hezbollah lawmaker also said, Lebanon's firm position and the resistance movement's efforts had helped the country safeguard its maritime rights in indirect talks with the Israeli regime and eventually forced the Zionist enemy to retreat. Lebanon and the Israeli regime carried out five sessions of indirect talks on the demarcation of maritime borders starting in 2020, with the latest round of talks being held in May of 2021. Since the negotiations kicked off, Hezbollah declared that the extraction of gas from Karish gas field without guarantees to Lebanon that it will be able to explore and extract its maritime resources is a red line. Lebanon's Al-Manar News Network explains more about the same story. A top official of the Lebanese resistance movement, Hezbollah, said Beirut has achieved its goals in the maritime dispute case with the Israeli regime without resorting to military action. The head of Hezbollah's political council, Ebrahim Amin al-Sayed, said on Saturday, 15th of October, that there is a generation in Lebanon that has crushed the power of the arrogant countries and foiled their wars against Lebanon. Ebrahim Amin al-Sayed said, Lebanon, thanks to the resistance and the unified national stance, has won in the case of its maritime wealth without needing to go to war to achieve this. Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Najib Mikati also said, the unified Lebanese stance and the country's adherence to its rights and demands have led to this positive outcome. Mirati made the statement as he received a copy of the final draft of the maritime border demarcation deal with the Israeli regime during his meeting with Parliament Deputy Speaker Elias Boussab. The Lebanese premier said he asked French company Total Energy to begin gas exploration in the country's territorial waters. U.S. President Joe Biden said on Tuesday, 11th of October, that Lebanon and Israel agreed to formally end their maritime border dispute and were ready to take the next steps. The Israeli regime's cabinet approved the deal on Wednesday, 12th of October, by a large majority. The agreement will be forwarded to the Israeli regime parliament, the Knesset, for a two-week review before a final cabinet vote. Moreover, Lebanon's private LBCI television network reports, a senior Lebanese politician says his country's demands have been met during indirect negotiations on a maritime border demarcation deal with the Israeli regime, emphasizing that the Hezbollah resistance movement imposed the equation of power on the Tel Aviv regime in this case. The leader of the Free Patriotic Movement of Lebanon, Gibran Barcel, said Hezbollah imposed the equation of power and Lebanon obtained its demand in the course of talks about maritime border demarcation with Israel. The prominent Christian politician said he had earlier stated that the natural gas must be extracted from both the Karish gas field in the eastern Mediterranean Sea and the Qana gas field. He declared none will be extracted without the other. Gibran Barcel said, "It was the resistance front which drew up to impose and imposed the equation of power on the Israeli regime. This manifestly shows how beneficial Hezbollah is for Lebanon. Shouldn't we make use of such a capacity?" After submitting the final draft of the deal to President Michel Aoun, Lebanon's negotiator Elias Boussab said, "Lebanon has obtained its full rights and all of its remarks have been taken into account." He added that the final draft takes into consideration all of Lebanon's requirements and we believe that the other side should feel the same. Michel Aoun had previously said that a deal would not signify a partnership with the Israeli regime as the two sides are technically at war. In February of 2018, Lebanon signed its first contract for drilling in two blocks in the Mediterranean Sea with a consortium comprising of energy giants Total, Eni and Novatek. Lebanon and the Israeli regime took part in indirect talks to discuss demarcation in 2020. But the talks stalled after Lebanon demanded a larger area, including part of the Karish gas field, which the Israeli regime had given exploration rights to a Greek firm. According to a map sent to the United Nations in 2011, the talks were supposed to discuss a Lebanese demand for 860 square kilometers of territory in the disputed maritime area. However, Lebanon then said the map was based on erroneous calculations and demanded 1,430 square kilometers, more further south, including part of the Karish gas field.
Bazaar.
Following the success of the first industrial park in 1890, more of these parks began mushrooming all over the world. Industrial zones are viewed as an effective way of increasing synergies between industrial activities through sharing resources. Furthermore, they drive commerce and business for greater economic stability among global and domestic participants. These days, industrial parks are key engines for economic growth and financial security. Hello and welcome to another edition of Bazaar, the program that analyzes industries, markets, profits, and all sorts of things that connect us nationally and internationally. This week, we are going to explore Iran's industrial parks. We wanted to see how they are established and operated and who the major players are in this field. Plus, we will examine why industrial parks and estates are so important to the national economy. So, let's get started. To become more familiar with industrial parks, we visited one on the outskirts of the capital city of Tehran. It was originally launched roughly 3 decades ago and has since grown into one of the most densely packed industrial zones of the province. Spanning some 260 hectares of land, this establishment is home to hundreds of producers active in several production fields. So how does this establishment work and what makes industrial parks attractive to businesses? One answer is that these zones offer unique services that support investors and companies. However, one of the most important advantages is the large plots of land fitted with the necessary infrastructure for production and distribution. Each year, thousands of tons of products are produced here. Industrial parks also provide vast amounts of space to store goods, and some have their own airports and ground terminals for cargo distribution. But that's not all. Many industrial parks are also situated in economic zones, which offer numerous benefits to businesses while cutting some of their development costs. Additionally, there are other advantages to operating in industrial zones for manufacturers who are also exporters. These include softer customs regulations and certain tax exemptions, among others. As a result, exports from these areas have also contributed millions of dollars to the national economy.
Industrial zones are ideal catalysts for industrialization and economic development. They provide the infrastructure necessary for small and medium-sized enterprises to grow. These parks have emerged as the new super tonic for the unprecedented growth of urban business and commerce. But have you ever wondered how an industrial park is created? It's no easy task. Planning and launching one of these zones is considered an industry of its own.
We caught up with a holding company specializing in planning and developing industrial parks in Tehran province. We wanted to see how these establishments are shaped, executed, and launched. It all starts with targeting the appropriate plot of land. This holding purchases the necessary land, which sometimes can cover hundreds of hectares. This entity carries out its activities under the National Small Industries and Industrial Parks Organization. This organization is affiliated with the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade. So, the holding links various industries with government executive branches and helps remove barriers for manufacturing units. Plus, it connects investors to businesses while handling some of the government's bureaucratic processes for national and international investors. One of the main goals of creating these parks is to support local production and increase exports. Doing so will save the country millions on importing similar goods that can be domestically produced. At its core, an industrial park is a portion of a city or land zoned for industrial use rather than residential or commercial needs. These places can be home to a host of industries and might have oil refineries, power plants, ports, and so much more.
The The parks serve another purpose too. They are also meant to protect the environment, as industrial parks collect factories and other manufacturing facilities in an area outside of town. Moreover, these zones foster technological learning and innovation while creating jobs. Plus, such sites provide intermediary support for institutions while promoting interdisciplinary networks.
Their activities support market expansion and reach by providing services to companies that help businesses stay relevant in the competitive market. For instance, this holding company has sponsored various national and international exhibitions where companies in industrial zones can participate. They offer dozens of types of services to small and medium-sized businesses both inside industrial parks and outside these zones. It might be interesting to know that nearly every province of Iran has at least one of these holding companies that establishes industrial parks. For example, the holding company for Tehran province has already established numerous estates and sites over the years, but its activities haven't stopped there. As part of its future vision, this holding hopes to expand its activities, and one of its projects is launching more industrial parks focusing on knowledge-based production. Generally speaking, the number of industrial parks has increased by over 270-fold since the Islamic Revolution in 1979. Presently, there are over 1,000 industrial parks and zones scattered across the country. Over 830 of this total has been handed over to industrial units. That's all based on figures from the Ministry of Industry, Mining and Trade. All things considered, Iran's industrial zones have a bright and promising future while offering lucrative investment opportunities with big profits. The construction industry has continuously had a series of revolutions throughout history. Technological advancements have influenced the construction sector too, from durable concrete in ancient structures to smart windows that automatically open and close based on light exposure. Some materials evolved with time, others are new to the industry and address natural disasters while reflecting changing lifestyles and environmental values. Still, other materials are born out of a need to reduce construction costs. In a nutshell, structures and their materials are the building blocks of society and economic expansion. To understand the enormity of the construction industry, we visited the 22nd Annual International Building and Construction Exhibition in Tehran. Because the exhibition was sprawled over nearly 4 hectares of land, one day is not nearly enough for visitors to see the entire expo, so it ran for 3 days. This exhibition is one of the most important events in its industry. We caught up with a few companies at the exhibit to see what they were offering. Our first stop was at a booth held by a company that makes ceramic tiles. They also export their products to numerous countries. Next, we stopped by a company specializing in manufacturing faucets and kitchen and bathroom attachments. It also purchases most of its raw materials from inside the country. Like many we have seen at the event, this company has created many job opportunities directly and indirectly. Plus, it uses the latest machinery to make high-quality products that compete with foreign brands. Now, many might not think twice about it, but Iran's faucet and fixture production have been booming. So we spoke with another company that has been exporting these items for years.
Industry participants say this year's Building Expo was much larger than last year's, meaning that Iran's construction industry has expanded in recent years, displaying the country's various existing and emerging capabilities in the field. Statistics show that last year some 900 domestic companies participated in the event. Also, foreign companies were present, offering their goods and services.
This year's exhibit hosted hundreds of foreign companies from Germany, Australia, Turkey, China, Spain, Italy, South Korea, and Malaysia, just to name a few. A wealth of products were showcased at the expo, from road and construction equipment to stones, sanitary supplies, heating and cooling systems, lifts and elevators, and so much more. Rarely has any industry offered so much versatility and variety of products as the construction industry. Events like this one offer a platform for the exchange of ideas, examining markets and opportunities for collaboration to create new products needed in the market. Next, we stopped by a display for a company specializing in making various inset kitchen products. We asked them about their goods and approach to challenges posed by the US sanctions. Walking through the exhibit, we ran into a company that makes metal fittings for stairs, windows, and areas that require spatial separations. All things considered, the construction sector has been significant for the Iranian economy. The sector is divided into two main parts: government infrastructure projects and the housing industry. The construction industry has been thriving due to national and international investment to the extent that it is now one of the largest in the West Asia region. This sector suffered a lot after the US withdrew from the 2015 deal and reimposed sanctions against Iran. These measures choked construction materials import. As a result, the steady flow of things like metals to Iran was seriously hampered and eventually halted altogether. But despite the bans, this industry continues to grow and is also one of the few that exports services to other countries. Based on the Association of Iranian Exports of Technical and Engineering Services, Iran currently has the potential to export engineering services worth $40 billion annually. The country already exports these services to countries around the Caspian Sea, its bordering neighbors, South and Central America, North Africa, and South Asia. Some construction projects include sewage treatment plants, dams, and energy plants. According to the Ministry of Industry, Mining, and Trade, Iran is self-sufficient in construction material production. Steel, glass, and cement are abundantly produced in the country. Moreover, the surplus of these items is exported to countries worldwide. Government officials say they have plans to expand exports to Iran's trade partners, including China and Russia. For example, the Ministry of Industry, Mine and Trade says it plans to sell upwards of $3 billion worth of construction materials to Russia alone. As a whole, the government views the construction sector as a feasible alternative for generating foreign revenues and diversifying the country's economy away from oil profits. And now it's time for me to take a quick break and hand it over to my good friend out in the field who has prepared an exciting report for us.
In ancient Iran, felt was already used in the production of numerous kinds of clothing, bed clothes, floor carpets, and different kinds of sacks. In fact, the Iranian world may have been an important center for the development of felt technology. In the modern world today, felt or namat has found its way to industries of all kinds in various forms.
You just can't imagine how crowded this place is. Whenever I want to talk on the phone, I have to find a sign-up place to be able to talk to you. It's really crazy. God, in today's chaotic society, stress is an issue that many of us suffer from every day. But what matters most is trying to find distress sources and try to find effective solutions. For this reason, today I'm here to tell you that I finally found a startup, a new innovative company that has finally found a solution to this disastrous problem. I won't tell you any further. Let's just go and check it out.
Felt, or so-called namat, is the acoustic solution for rowdy places to absorb and decrease undesirable noises. The aim is to provide sound serenity and to improve physical, mental, and psychological health. Namat Studio's scope of work is based on designing and manufacturing products. Recently, it has also played a significant role in different projects like some innovation centers in Asia and Africa. This company has focused on designing and building acoustic products. Generally in Iran, there is no specific competitor in this field. However, there are some groups in America and Northern Europe that are engaged with felt.
If I want to tell you about a history about how our company established, it goes back to 3 years ago when Diva was chosen to renovate the innovation factory of Iran, that was the biggest one in the time. And the designer tried to make the offices and they tried to design a place that the people be comfortable, have a good place to work. That's why we understand that we have some advantages and disadvantages. One of the disadvantages is about the sound pollution that we had in the this area, that places were noisy and the employees didn't like that. That's why we try to use special materials for control this sound pollution. And we reached the felt material and we try to use this material.
Designing acoustic and movable working stations with the aim of recycling old products and reuse them in different functions. What is worth noticing about this business is the fact that the problem-solution method is based upon three WH questions: why, how, and what. Why is to define the problem, how is the process towards the solution, and what is the final product and prototype. These acoustic solutions were combined with architecture in various parts of the space and played the role in sound insulation and creating a silent space. All right, now I want to walk you through some of the major products that are made of felt. The first piece we have here is an artwork that is made of wool felt that acts as a sound-absorbing material, not only as an aesthetic material that you can put it in your home place, but also as a sound-absorbing material. There is a phone booth. If I get inside, I can feel the private space and how the atmosphere really changes. It improves the acoustic vibes and reduces the reverberation when I get inside. And there's desk divider. It's actually one of the main products in this company. People and employees put it in their on their desk to divide their own workplace with the person right next to them.
We have three different kind of material that we use on our works that absorb undesirable sounds, which are wool panels, or the other name is felt, and in Persian we say namat, and thermofelt and carpet. And the felt are in two kind of industrial felt and the natural felt. Natural felt is made by wools, and industrial material is made by a process by the battles and pet materials. They have different color patterns and thicknesses. The thicknesses are from 3 millimeter to 50 millimeter. And about the thermofelt, we have this material that we can use for more absorption. It has three kind of material with polyester, jeans, and heavy traffic, and it's very good for absorbing. And the last one is the carpet that is heavy traffic that we use in heavy traffic places such as the offices, and it can be cleaned very easy by the vacuum cleaner.
As I mentioned earlier, this idea was created based on the concept of recreating, recycling, and revitalizing the surrounding substances and generalizing this idea to the upcoming products with different potentials. Such small-scale products are intended to improve the mental and physical health of users. And finally, creating a comfortable, inviting atmosphere.
Just like linear lighting, almost everything here is made of felt. Based on environmental psychology, this linear lighting has been created in a way to provide maximum visual and acoustic comfort in the workplace, especially a co-working space like this. This company, Namad Startup, has been trying to promote sustainability and also take steps towards industrialization. Among all the products here, there were so many things, but I decided to choose this felt laptop case to carry my laptop with me wherever I go. So it's not about the ideas, it's about making the ideas happen. I'm Sarah Dema.
We're almost near the end of our program, but before we go, let's take a look at some news and trends on industrial parks and other related traits. As the number of industrial parks in the country grows, so does the maintenance cost of these areas. Iran's Small Industries and Industrial Parks Organization, or ISIPO, says over half of these parks are in need of renovation.
The organization says around 60% of the country's industrial parks are over 15 years old and need maintenance and overhauls. Based on official figures, nearly 50,000 industrial units have started their activities in these parks. However, the ISIPO says it is limited in how much help it can provide these industrial areas to effectively maintain them. The organization says the government needs to give it more authority to do so. Iran's industrial parks play a critical role in making the country independent by boosting production in a bid to nullify the U.S.-imposed sanctions on the economy.
Summertime is usually the season where electricity consumption reaches its peak, but unfortunately that's also when most power cuts happen. So, Tehran province officials have now devised a solution to prevent blackouts in industrial parks.
After a brainstorming session, provincial officials have decided to set up several solar power stations to provide a steady supply of electrical power during peak use periods. The power stations will generate up to 1,200 megawatts of electricity for the country's power grid. Plus, these stations will help supply electricity to 19 of the province's industrial parks, where some 6,000 businesses are operating. This solution comes after the Energy Ministry devised a plan to systematically cut off electricity supply to industrial parks during peak use. This program aimed to manage the capital's electricity supply and prevent blackouts for household consumers.
And our last news topic covers Iran's deepening ties with its neighbor, Turkmenistan. The two countries have recently inked a memorandum of understanding.
Under the deal, Iran's ISIPO has agreed to share experience and transfer knowledge related to developing industrial parks to the Turkmen side. These include design, engineering, and consultations for setting up industrial towns in special economic zones. Other topics in the MOU include bolstering entrepreneurship and developing small industries and tech parks. The two sides also signed several other cooperation documents during a visit of Turkmenistan's president to Iran.
That wraps up our program for today. On behalf of the entire team, thank you for tuning in.
Comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Former U.S. President Donald Trump sought to cut a deal with the National Archives to trade records he took from the White House to Mar-a-Lago late last year for sensitive documents about the FBI investigation of his 2016 campaign ties to Russia, according to the New York Times. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The website Salon.com has more on this story. Former President Donald Trump sought to cut a deal with the National Archives to trade records he took from the White House to Mar-a-Lago late last year for sensitive documents about his alleged 2016 campaign ties to Russia. The exchange never happened, but Donald Trump floated the idea to his aides. The National Archives had pressed Donald Trump to return the documents stored at his Florida estate at Mar-a-Lago, but Trump spent a year and a half delaying their requests. He was upset with the National Archives' unwillingness to hand over the documents that ostensibly backed his claims in the Russia probe, according to the New York Times. Upon entering the White House, Donald Trump formed a habit of bringing documents back to his bedroom, according to the report. Halfway through his term in office, tracking files in the White House became an obstacle, and by his third year in office, some documents ended up in places where they should not have been, according to individuals familiar with the situation who spoke to the New York Times. At the end of his presidency, White House counsel Pat Cipollone called for Donald Trump to return documents that had piled up in boxes in the White House, according to archives officials, the New York Times reported. The top lawyer for the National Archives, Gary Stern, also demanded that Donald Trump return the classified files from Mar-a-Lago in a letter in 2021. It is also our understanding that roughly 24 boxes of original presidential records were kept in the residence of the White House over the course of President Trump's last year in office and have not been transferred to the National Archives and Record Administration, despite a determination by Pat Cipollone in the final days of the administration that they need to be, Stern wrote. Throughout the year, Gary Stern continued to press Donald Trump's team to have him hand over the boxes. He even spoke with the former White House Chief of Staff Mark Meadows and three lawyers who worked in the White House's counsel's office. At the end of last year, as Gary Stern pushed for Donald Trump to return the documents, Trump told Mark Meadows that the boxes he took from the White House merely contained newspaper clippings and personal items. Even such documents seen by Trump while in office were considered presidential records, the archives informed Donald Trump's team. Still, Trump did not return any boxes. Former White House advisor Eric Hirschman also told Donald Trump near the end of his last year that he could encounter significant legal problems if he didn't return the records to the National Archives, according to the New York Times. The website truthout.org has more on the same story. In late 2021, after nearly a year of attempts from the National Archives and Records Administration to obtain government records that Donald Trump had improperly removed from the White House, the former president told his advisers that he would return the records in exchange for documents relating to the Russia investigation. Donald Trump still determined to show he had been wronged by the FBI investigation into his 2016 campaign ties to Russia, suggested to his aides that they bargain for materials related to the inquiry by offering the National Archives and Record Administration the White House records he was keeping at his estate at Mar-a-Lago, according to reporting from the New York Times. For years, Donald Trump has denounced the Russia investigation, which was led by former special counsel Robert Mueller, and sought to determine whether or not Russia interfered in the 2016 presidential election on Donald Trump's behalf. Trump reportedly wanted documents from the Russia investigation because he believed that the National Archives and Record Administration had previously refused to disclose documents that would back up his unsubstantiated claims regarding the inquiry. The former president has frequently stated that the Russia investigation exonerated him of any wrongdoing. However, Robert Mueller has stated otherwise, noting that many of Donald Trump's actions could constitute obstruction of justice in the eyes of federal prosecutors. Trump's aides ultimately rejected the proposal to bargain for the documents with the National Archives and Record Administration. Later that year, Donald Trump relented and agreed to allow the National Archives and Record Administration to retrieve some documents from his Mar-a-Lago estate in Palm Beach, Florida, but only after the agency threatened to get Congress involved. When the National Archives and Record Administration examined the documents it retrieved in early 2022, officials noticed that many were marked as classified, prompting them to reach out to the Department of Justice. In June of 2022, the Department of Justice subpoenaed Donald Trump to return additional documents marked as classified and had his legal counsel sign an affidavit affirming that no more documents were at Mar-a-Lago.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Beijing's Great Hall of the People saw Xi Jinping, the Secretary General of the Chinese Communist Party, attempt to cement his power by setting out to clinch an unprecedented third five-year term as president. In his address to some 2,300 officials and delegates from across the country, he laid out his policies and lauded some of his government's achievements. Among those achievements, President Xi reiterated the validity of his harsh zero-COVID policies. Policies which, to this day,